Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, March 27, 2015. Once again, rebels and the South Sudan Army violate the cessation of hostility agreement as fighting breaks out in Jonglei and Unity States.
The fighting took place from 5:30 up to 7 a.m. when the rebel forces were defeated and they withdrew, leaving behind them 54 of their dead soldiers. These 54 dead bodies include 5 officers.
And South Sudan has good news for internet users.
What will happen is that the amount of data transfer will be increased per time. For example, you need to transfer like 20 megabytes per second. You can also do that, but with the low broadbands, that will not be possible.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A spokesman for the South Sudan Army says its forces killed more than 50 rebel fighters in Jonglei State's Ayot County and Unity State's Bentiu on Wednesday, and that 3 of its soldiers were killed in the fighting. Colonel Philip Aguirre says it was the rebels who launched the attack. Colonel Aguirre says aside from the 3 government soldiers killed, 13 others were wounded in the fighting that continued for several hours in both Jonglei and Unity States.
The fighting took place from 5:30 up to 7 a.m. when the rebel forces were defeated and they withdrew, leaving behind them 54 of their dead soldiers. These 54 dead bodies include 5 officers.
Aguirre says the SPLA is in control of Ayot and says calm has returned to the village. But SPLM in opposition military spokesman James Loyne paints a different picture. He says his forces now control Ayot, although fighting there continues and that government forces launched the attacks in both Ayot and Unity State capital of Bentiu, not the other way round.
In their dry offensive, Ayot, that is Jonglei, Launuer and Bentiu, were part of the areas we were defending our positions. They came to attack the Launuer, but again, when they were repulsed, then the war continued up to Ayot, where they were. And actually, Ayot was our area, actually. They invaded it. Now, that is the same thing with our situation in Bentiu. Because in Bentiu, they came out to invade our places, and then when we repulsed them back, this is where we reach up to the town of Bentiu. Now, what happened is that today, we have actually flushed out that this army in Ayot as a result of this aggression, and we have captured 2 tanks. And we have destroyed artillerists mounted on the vehicles, 3 of them, and we have killed many of them.
And Lon says fighting continues in Bentiu.
Our people have taken half of Bentiu yesterday, and this morning, because of the Suraya, we have not yet confirmed that they are finally flushed out, but we are in town in Bentiu.
Colonel Aguirre insists the rebels once again attacked government positions in Bentiu.
The rebel tried to shell Bentiu town for the 3rd time in a week, and the SPLA responded, and the clash outside Bentiu town between Bentiu and Nialdiu in a place called Deal, the rebels were dispersed, and the SPLA is in full control of Bentiu and the surroundings.
IGAD announced in April of last year that it deployed officers to monitor and verify ceasefire violations in the area around Bentiu. Aguirre says government forces find it meaningless to report the rebels' aggression because, in his words, the rebels have never accepted the principle of monitoring and verification. He wants that government forces will not sit by and watch the rebels continue to attack their positions.
The government army remain committed to the regional and international effort to bring peace to South Sudan. However, the army have the obligation to protect the territorial integrity of the Republic of South Sudan and protect the civilians in these towns. So we'll continue to defend ourselves and fight back in self-defense up to the time the rebel will accept the ceasefire and peace is brought to South Sudan.
This latest round of fighting comes within days of a warning by the United Nations Security Council that it stands ready to issue sanctions against any individual who obstructs the peace process in South Sudan. UN officials say nearly 2 million people have been displaced by the fighting in South Sudan and 2.5 million are going hungry. Waki Simon Wudu met some of South Sudanese women in the village of Ganyel who are surviving on the food ration they get from aid agencies. The women say the warring sides in South Sudan have dashed their hopes far for peace.
23-year-old Elizabeth Nyalat and her young child live with Nyalat's mother in the village of Ganiel in Unity State.
I was in here, therefore, and I came here on 10. And 15, the crisis will happen in Juba.
Ye is about 360 miles south of Ganiel. Nyalat says life was good in Ye and also in Ganiel before South Sudan erupted in conflict. But since then, she says things have completely changed. Nyalat is among tens of thousands of South Sudanese who have been living hand-to-mouth in Ganiel and surrounding Panyajar County since the fighting started. Many people here survive on meager food rations that they get from the World Food Program or WFP. Nyalat and her family get 4 kilograms or just under 9 pounds of food per person per month from the WFP. Nyalat says she uses up rations in just 2 weeks. For the rest of the month, she says she gets by using the little bit of money her mother earns as a cook for one of the aid agencies to buy extra food.
Here it is very tough. Even here situation is very hard in Ganyel. At least if world food come, it will be better.
Nyalat is one of an estimated 3 million South Sudanese whom aid agencies are trying to reach with the emergency food aid. Humanitarian agencies and the United Nations have been warning since last year of the possibility of famine in South Sudan. Nyalat has followed the peace talks that have been underway between President Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar for the past 14 months. She says that every time the two men have met, she expected they would sign an agreement to end the fighting and let people like her go home. Mr. Kiir and Machar have held face-to-face talks at least 4 times since the conflict began. Nyalat has been disappointed every time because there is still no peace deal.
I hope, but it has not happened now because every day that we are going for peace and no peace. I just looking for them. It will happen as a peace or not, I will see.
Elizabeth Nyamet gets 28 kilograms of food rations each month for her 7 family members. She says people in Ganiel are hurting as attempts to end the conflict drag on.
Everything are very expensive. Our life is not good, really. For me, I don't know the peace will come when, I don't know, really, because now I'm very tired. We are very suffering for the war. We don't know the time peace will come.
WFP spokesperson for South Sudan, Georgie Fomian, says emergency food aid often has to be airlifted to places in South Sudan where it is needed because of security concerns and poor infrastructure. Airdrops are one of the costliest ways to deliver food and supplies, but during the rainy season, they become one of the only ways to do so because many of South Sudan's roads become impassable. The rain season usually starts in April.
At this time this year, within the next 6 months, WFP needs like 278 million for its life-saving and resilience building activities so that we may be able to keep up, get the food in time, move it to the various places and so on.
Nyamet says in spite of their best efforts, the aid agencies are falling short.
We are affected by the hungries and the disease, how it breaks, even the shortage of drugs, even the water. Waiting food is not easy. Maybe we spend almost 3 months without getting food. We just go on the river and prepare the water lilies. That is the food we will wait for the WFP.
WFP Executive Director Atherin Kazin warned during a visit to South Sudan last week that an entire generation of South Sudanese could be lost to violence and hunger if the fighting does not stop soon. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Telecommunication experts in South Sudan are working to connect the country to a regional fiber optic cable network from Kenya to solve the acute internet-related problems facing local and international organizations operating in South Sudan. The Minister for Telecommunications and Postal Services, Rebecca Joshua Okwachi, says the launch of the National Broadband Network this month will enable users to buy internet bundles and make it easier to receive and send information on the internet. Philip Thornaleu has the story.
Minister Okwachi says up until recently, South Sudanese have had to rely on individual internet providers, which presents huge challenges, including questionable service. Okwachi says connecting the country to the optic fiber cable network will not only provide better internet service, but will keep users updated on the latest technological advances.
So with the modern knowledge, there is a lot to learn. You also need to update yourself every other day. You know, technology gets obsolete very quickly.
Earlier this month, Okwacha's ministry launched the National Broadband Network. This, according to experts, will lead to optimal bandwidths of data transmission. David Cholmanyok is an assistant lecturer of information, communications and technology at the University of Juba. Manyok says, if implemented, the National Broadband Network will vastly improve internet speed.
Then the data transmission rate is also increased. The data traffic, data flow is also increased. And there is no limited connections. You can buy from one person and the other person also buy from the other person in that without restriction.
Manyok says South Sudanese currently rely on internet providers from abroad and mainly through satellite networks, which he says are limited, adverse and expensive. He says the new National Broadband Network Initiative will change all that.
What will happen is that the amount of data transfer will be increased per time. For example, you need to transfer like 20 megabytes per second. You can also do that, but with the low broadbands, that will not be possible.
Since being appointed to her force in 2013, Okwachi says she has made some progress in improving communication services nationwide. She says all main South Sudanese towns and some villages now have access to mobile telephone coverage.
I travel to the field and really practically see, and that's what I've been doing, going to various parts of our country to see into it that the network infrastructure is in place, that I'm seeing the antenna, that I'm seeing the generator, that there is network.
Okwachi says it is all in preparation for the fiber optic network. We will come to South Sudan through Uganda or Kenya, allowing the ministry to launch a national broadband network. She says planning is still at the technical level, but when those issues are resolved and an agreement is reached with Uganda or Kenya, workers will begin digging along roadsides to plan the fiber optic cable. She says that process should take about 6 months according to the current work plan. Manyok says the project is a win-win for South Sudan. It will provide jobs for unemployed youth and eventually become a source of income for the Ministry of Telecommunications and Postal Services.
The ministry will be the one receiving tariff from the customers, and the customers also pay tariff to the other people who will connect through the vendors, and all the tariff will come mainly to the ministries.
For the time being, Manyok says, South Sudanese will have to contain with the sporadic internet access available in the country. Okwachi says her ministry will expedite the broadband network project as soon as possible, but could not say exactly when it will begin. For VOA News, I am Philip Thornaleu in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Join us next week for a series of programs on food insecurity in South Sudan and other parts of Africa. That's from Monday to Friday. We'll bring you a series of programs on food insecurity in South Sudan and other parts of Africa. Coming up, we take a closer look at how South Sudanese struggle to get clean and safer drinking water.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is the international community involved enough or too much in your country?
Yes, they have involved because, for example, for the crisis which is progressing in South Sudan, there is IGAD, which is trying to negotiate and to reconcile the two parties. They have also provided, they have involved in providing some food.
I keep finding it basically in Africa, and I think it's an international community. So to me, a part of me, a very big part of me, feels that it is very much involved, more than it should be.
We have been so blessed by international community because the tragedy that we passed through in 1994, we were really helped by the international community.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Following last Sunday's World Water Day commemoration, experts continue to search for better ways to improve water supply in developing countries. Mungume Debs Rakaring visited a few people in eastern Equatorial State to embark on a long journey to access clean water.
Every day, before tending to his fields and working for other farmers, 22-year-old Omal Glole from Palwal Boma in eastern Equatorial State rides his motorbike some 4 kilometers to fetch 4 plastic containers or jerrycans of water from a nearby stream. He must ensure he has at least 8 liters for his family of 4, including his wife and 2 children.
Because it's very far, so I have to use a motorbike to carry the water. It is very expensive because getting money here to buy fuel, just you have to do work for someone there, then they pay you, then you go and buy with the fuel, then you go and carry water.
Glory says he spends 5 South Sudanese pounds to buy fuel for his motorbike each day. He makes money 3 ways: farming his land, working for other farmers, and occasionally working as a boda-boda driver. Today, Glole is shifting gears by working on his family home. He needs at least 20 jerrycans of water, which costs at least 25 South Sudanese pounds. He needs the water to mix clay into a mud, which he uses to form the walls of his house. 21-year-old Abalo Agnes has decided to bring her family's dirty clothes to the Jama River rather than carry water back home. The young mother of one lives in an extended family of 15 and is responsible for not only washing the clothes but tilling the garden and making sure there's enough water for everyone at home. Other women are busy fetching water for drinking and cleaning from the same place in the Jama River where Agnes is washing her family's dirty laundry. Agnes says she must forego household chores and even neglect her garden for days at a time in order to haul water back and forth.
We used to face with my sister sometime I'm alone. When you are in your field work, in case you run shortage of water, you may stop doing that work and it can affect your farm product.
United Nations researchers estimate that women in developing countries have less time to deal with other domestic duties because they spend so much time traveling on foot to fetch water. According to the Paris-based NGO, Agency for Technical Cooperation and Development, 768 million people worldwide do not have proper access to water. Nearly two-thirds of South Sudanese lack access to safe drinking water. Many, like Agnes, fear the river water is not clean.
When it rains heavily, gully erosion also can affect us when coming from the roadside. Coming this way, you may find that all the water are very dirty. Not only that, some people also, they used to dispose waste product here, like maybe rotten organism, even feces.
Oluk James Robbins, the director of the Palwal Boma Health Program, says there are only 2 hand-pumped boreholes serving 14,000 residents in the community, forcing many to fetch water from the Jama River. He says many of them suffer from waterborne diseases.
In the most case, diarrhea is the one affecting this area. That is one. And another one, we have worms. We have hookworm, actually, and we have bloody diarrhea. When it comes in the rainy season, we can get even typhoid. Yeah, waste is very difficult to manage.
James Robbins advises locals to boil water before drinking or to use purification tablets or chlorine. But despite his warnings, he says many residents of Palwal continue to drink dirty water. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rakaring.
Our next story looks at the border issues between Kenya and Somalia. The Kenyan government is taking dramatic new steps to secure its borders with Somalia by erecting a wall designed to keep out militants after a series of cross-border raids by Al-Shabaab militants. But experts are divided on whether the initiative is the long-awaited solution to Kenya's security problems or misguided effort. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Northeastern Kenya borders both Ethiopia and Somalia. For more than two decades since the collapse of Somalia's central government in 1990s, the region has suffered incursions from Somalia, and more recently, frequent raids by the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group Al-Shabaab. With danger increasing, Kenyan officials are working on building a wall along parts of the border, while keeping roads open for trade and easy access for security officials to respond to any attack. Interior Ministry spokesman Mwenda Njoka tells VOA the intention is to improve security in areas where the danger is greatest and open routes for people to safely cross the border.
There are specific entry points, specific exit points. So there are certain areas that we may have to put physical actions. Other places we may need to put whether it's walls or fences, but it's not a wall that runs the entire 700 kilometers of their border.
The county government says Al-Shabaab has killed more than 100 people in Mandera in the last 4 months. The Somali Islamist group vowed and delivered multiple revenge attacks against Kenya after Nairobi sent troops into Somalia in 2011 to fight alongside an African Union force. The insecurity has also crippled education in northeastern Kenya, where hundreds of teachers have refused to go back to their schools after militiamen attacked a bus carrying educators late last year, killing 28 people. Security analyst Andrew Franklin says building walls will help in the face of scant border patrols.
It's a comprehensive solution. You know, putting up barriers, whether they're physical or electronic, is nothing without humans. It is not the only answer, but it is the primary answer, because right now we don't have enough staff, we don't have enough personnel to man the entire border that is completely open. And what we want to do is try to restore order along the border with Somalia.
Kenya media reports some leaders from northern Kenya have welcomed the initiative, saying it will reduce the number of terrorists crossing and it will also help curb illegal border trade. But others warn the wall is not the complete solution, as it won't help against Al-Shabaab sympathizers already in Mandera County. Independent security analyst Abdulwahab Sheikh Abdi Samad says security in the north can be improved if officials and civilians work together. Otherwise, the project means little.
What is the significance of building the wall right now? Are they going to minimize the Al-Shabaab fighters who are now crossing over into Kenya? So nobody knows. Kenya must gain the hearts and the minds of the northern people so that together they can easily defeat Al-Shabaab. Otherwise, you know, building a wall doesn't help the matter.
The militant group has lost ground in the last couple of years in the face of a concerted military effort by African Union troops and Somali forces. But Al-Shabaab has continued carrying out suicide and hit-and-run attacks. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
We now move to Nigeria, where all eyes will be on the country this weekend as voters line up at polls across the nation Saturday to cast ballots in presidential and parliamentary elections. But what happens after that is anyone's guess, and some fear the worst. Chris Stein reports from Kano on worries of a violent aftermath of what is widely expected to be a close race.
When results in Nigeria's presidential election are announced, the biggest question may not be how will the winners celebrate, but how will the losers handle the news? Will supporters of opposition candidate Muhammadu Buhari and his All Progressives Congress stay calm if he loses his fourth attempt at winning the presidency? What about if voters unseat incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan and his ruling People's Democratic Party, which has controlled the presidency since 1999? What if the new voting procedures the Electoral Commission put in place don't work and people can't cast their ballots? And how about Boko Haram, the Islamist extremist group that has threatened to disrupt the vote? The northern city of Kano has borne the brunt of several Boko Haram attacks, including a suicide bomb and shooting attack at its main mosque in November. It was also the site of rioting after the 2011 elections, when Buhari supporters accused officials of rigging the vote for Mr. Jonathan. That spasm of violence left more than 800 people dead, mostly in the country's north. Civil servant Ahmed Ibrahim says he thinks the police can protect voters. But he fears partisan violence, particularly if voters heed the advice of some politicians who have encouraged people to remain at polling stations after casting ballots as a way to stop fraud.
When you vote, just let. You know what you bought. People know what they bought. And at that scene, there is no way they can read this election. So staying there can cause a lot of problems, what I'm thinking.
A Kano police spokesman says law enforcement is shutting down roads between the states at midnight tonight and during the voting tomorrow. Housewife Hajia Ture Ibrahim says she's confident these preparations will prevent any Boko Haram attacks. Ibrahim says she's comfortable that the security preparations will protect voters from any of the unrest seen in the Northeast, where Boko Haram is particularly strong. She says the government has been speaking with young people to urge them to remain peaceful during the vote. But political violence flared up this week in the southern Niger Delta region. Voters in Rivers State have long supported Mr. Jonathan. But the 2013 defection of the state governor, Chibuke Rotimi Amaechi, to the opposition party has inflamed tensions in the state. On Thursday, gunmen tried to assassinate Amaechi as he campaigned in the state capital, Port Harcourt. His supporters accused the ruling party of being behind the attack. In recent weeks, Port Harcourt has been rocked by a series of fatal gun battles that Sofiri Job Peterside, a sociology lecturer at the University of Port Harcourt, says are politically motivated.
There are those who purchase this violence. And experience has shown that in this part of the country, those who possess and control the instruments of violence also controls the processes, the electoral processes, and eventually controls the results.
The two major presidential candidates met in the capital of Abuja on Thursday and released a joint statement, pledging to respect the outcome of the vote. Only time will tell what effect that will have on the streets of Nigeria once the polls are closed. Chris Stein for VOA News, Kano, Nigeria.
And that report by Stein brings us to the end of our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Malaika by Freedom Boys.
Malaika, 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 Malaika.
You've been listening to Freedom Boys with the song Malaika. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. You have a peaceful weekend and remember to join us next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.